isn't too rigid, and that you have invested funds and assets and achieved a return that tribes in the lower 48 haven't. And second is the matter of the Bureau of Indian Affairs and its discretion. You can't get around the fact that there's a transaction cost from dealing with the Bureau, and whether it's slowing up new constitutions, constitutional amendments, or ordinances, the Bureau can slow you down and sometimes stall you. So I just feel that's an excellent point that has just been made, and I hope that there's widespread agreement up here that tribal sovereignty is something special that you must establish, I think, in a somewhat more protected form than you have now. I think the lower 48 form has much to commend it, but I hope you can find something that's somewhat different, more creative, more tailored to your needs here.
Well, just before we move on, maybe we could, Tim, would you like to add something to that, and then Sam?
Well, I could add a great deal to that, but mostly I just agree that's really quite right. I think there's been a tendency, especially on the part of those of us that are called experts, to assume that other things that we're familiar with, these known entities, this thing called Indian country or IRA governments or reservation status, that all of these kinds of things are somehow desirable, when they may be desirable in part. Some of those forms of organization and management might be better than some things that are now being done here, but they're not necessarily what one should aspire to. I wanted to respond to Browning's remarks this morning in that way, that yes, it might be good advice to say don't accept anything less than reservation status, but is it necessary to stop there? Why can't Alaskan Natives have it their own way and have at least those rights and some additional ones, maybe a lot of additional ones? Why not come up with a new kind of approach that would be more suitable up here and avoid the problems that we have down home? I mean, of course, when you're down in the lower 48, you hear nothing but complaints about the system that we have there, and it's really sort of odd to be in a position of ever suggesting that anyone else ought to adopt that. And that's my primary criticism of most of what I've heard, is this tendency to assume that somehow the existing models are something that we should try to use.
Sam George?
Thank you. I concur with some of the points made by Mr. Spud Williams and Mary and other legal experts here. But presently, you know, as I see it right now in a native village of Akkajok, is that, you know, there's a lot of potential for the development of, a tribal government. And the state of Alaska, you know, is in the stage right now of, you know, they have not dealt with, the tribal government authority. And the reasoning is that, you know, during the constitutional conventions that were held, there was very little involvement by the native people. And in most cases during the time, there was hardly anybody in the village that, especially the elderly, did not even understand, what's been going on. And I guess that's one of the main reasons why, the state of Alaska at this point does not recognize tribal governments, just because in the Constitution it states that they only will deal with the citizen, the borough governments. But I feel, and the three villages that have initiated the Upit Nation, we want to establish a government that was already in existence in our own terms, not in terms of, the expectations from the federal government nor the state government. And our elders are getting to a point where they want to formulate a government that would, you know, bring back, you know, what we had before, you know, as pre-ANSCA and pre-statehood. And they would prefer to, you know, reclaim all the land we have lost through ANSCA that we feel was illegal. And, you know, the reasoning behind the formulation of this new government was that we initiated in mind that someday in the future we'd have a regional government called the Yupik Nation. And, you know, looking at that, you know, there's a lot of potential that have not been exploited in the area of development of tribal government. And at this point, you know, in a village level, we have dealt with too many organizations, and we have meetings that last every week of the month. And we meet, you know, we serve under the village corporation. Then, you know, I myself and Willie here, he's the chairman of the IRA council. Then I'm a chairman of the village corporation. Then I'm working for him, and he's working for the village corporation. And that's basically, you know, it gets to a point where we can't, you know, we have a tendency to have, you know, a conflict of interest right there. You know, I have a tendency to get to a point where I'm really, you know, want to, you know, make the village corporation as successful as much as possible. And on the other hand, I want to just, you know, get away with it. But some of the ideas that I think, you know, some of the discussions or some of the ideas we had were that, you know, a tribal government, you know, we can have an umbrella of the tribal government over the native, you know, lands. And it does not have to be, you know, federal under trust status or any other status. And, you know, and at this point, our regional corporation is proposing a tribal government. They call it tribal council. And the reasoning behind
the regional corporation?
The Jalista Corporation is trying to initiate what they call a tribal government, just because, you know, there's too many organizations within AVCP region that speaks for the region. So I guess one solution, I guess what we're going to do is go in and tell them to bow down to the Yupik Nation soon. But that's basically what we'd like to see. And lastly, I'd like to point out that, you know, in our villages, we have always, you know, had some form of a court system that was informal, and it was cited, I think, by UCLA law review. And you know, there's a lot of potential in the area of developing, you know, a strong, you know, tribal government. And I feel that, you know, the state of Alaska should, well, I feel that the state, since it's been here only 25 years, you know, they're serving their own government, and we want to set our own terms as to what we want. Thank you.
Well, I think you mentioned the David Getchies.
Just had a question. If you set up that tribal government, would it replace the regional corporation?
Well, it's kind of, well, as far as the regional corporation, they seem to want to form a, you know, a government, but more likely what we have in mind is a regional government that would, you know, serve the interests of the people and have a complete jurisdiction over everything.
That would add another entity. You'd have even more boards and meetings and so on.
Well,
to deal
it's
with.
Well. There's been some regional talks about you know, dismantling some of the organization within the area, and I guess it would come to a point. Maybe we'll dissolve the regional corporation.
Sheldon.
Yes. One of the things that has, in thinking about possible alternatives, possible solutions to the problems that we are talking about, that we are discussing, one possible alternative, and this is just a rough structure. I've talked about it before the Federal State Tribal Relations Task Force, when they were asking, okay, we've heard enough of the problem, what are some possible solutions? One of the things, as I said, is it's rough, is a Congress of Alaska Natives. As it stands now, we are being regulated, our laws are being written from quite a distance off when you think of the perspective of the village. Juneau is a long way off, not only in terms of distance, but in terms of time and in terms of money. And yet, we are expected to abide by these regulations written by people who do not live in our area, who are unfamiliar with not only how we live, but where we live, and who, because of certain degrees given by generally post-secondary educational institutions at some greater distance away, that somehow that makes them an expert. It's our contention that as far as our land and resources are concerned, there is no greater expert than our own people. It's heartening to hear that the Yupik Nation, the people of the Bethel region, are talking about regional councils. That is one of the things I think that would be very necessary before we could in fact put in place something on the level of a Congress for Alaska Natives. One of the things that is foremost before we can do this is that we must recognize the viability of tribal governments. For the local people, it is their choice for a governing body, and they have the governmental powers. The federal government recognizes that to a certain extent. A regional tribal council, on the other hand, would provide that umbrella which is sensitive to the needs of our people to be able to say, okay, sure, we have a tribal government, we have a local government, but we are not sophisticated, we are not educated, nor do we have a desire to assume all the powers of government. So something must be done. Some structure must be put in place which will allow for the individual evolution at the local level of government. ANCSA had no provision for this. ANCSA's settlement was a blanket settlement that applied equally to every village, no matter how diverse they are one from the other. If we are going to have a solution, we must work in this recognition of the fact that each and every village is different, not only within a region, but also across the state. And we must provide for the desires of these people to say, if in fact they do not want any government, and that is how the majority of people live in the village, they are not governed. They live their life as they see fit. They harvest those resources that they find necessary for their day-to-day lives. And if in fact they say, we want the barest minimum of government, but yet we want these other powers of government not to be lost, we want a regional council to not usurp these powers, as is the case, but to say, okay, we will safeguard these powers until such time as you feel that you, as an individual government, can say, hey, give it back to me. I can do it now. Is that too much to ask? No, of course not. This would, again, provide for such things as we talked about earlier, a tribal court system. It is unreasonable to expect a village of 200, even 300, even 800, to say, okay, we can support a tribal court system, especially given the lack of funds that everybody says is the problem, not only at the state but at the federal level. We can do those things. The federal law, the state law, all say that they make allowances for and provide for priority subsistence use primarily by Alaska's natives. If in fact they do provide for priority use of subsistence resources by Alaska's natives, why then can they not regulate that on their own? They are not children. They know their resources. If anybody is an expert on those resources, the people that interact with those resources are in fact the most knowledgeable. Is that too much to ask? I don't think so. And again, I have to keep emphasizing that these things must come out not just from the village level to the non-native population of Alaska, or from the federal government to the native population of Alaska, but that we have to begin to inform ourselves of all these issues and then say, okay, our designated governments will sit down and negotiate these things to all our mutual satisfactions. Is that too much to ask? Of course not. These laws, these regulations, and there are stacks and stacks of books of regulations and laws both at the federal and at the state level which apply strictly to Alaska Natives. A point has been made by someone else that the Native American population, not only of the United States but of Alaska, are the most regulated. There are more laws written concerning the Native people, not only in the lower 48 but up here in Alaska, than any other group of people, including the whites. Why don't you let us regulate our own affairs? Is that too much to ask? This will provide, as far as subsistence resources, there is presently a lack of responsibility as far as Native people with regard to fish and game regulations. They say that does not fit my culture, that does not fit my tradition, that does not fit my heritage. I am not required by my own self to submit to being licensed to harvest that resource which my parents, my grandparents, my forefathers have always told me, take care of it. Your forefathers took care of it for you so that they could hand it down. We expect you to do the same thing. What happened in 1959, that tradition, that legacy, that inheritance, all of a sudden, by a statehood act and the assumption by the state that they in fact now control these fish and game resources, what we call food. In other words, they are now regulating our daily lives. Why can't we regulate our own? The United States does it. State of Alaska says they do that. Is it too much to ask to have our own people determine at what level of government and who will safeguard the other levels of government which we might not want to assume at the present time? In other words, the ability to say, yes, this is my government. Yes, I will be responsible to it, and yes, this government will deal with any and all other governments. But none of this will come about until the federal government, the state government, and the local governments can sit down, whether individually or as a group, and say, okay, let's outline the problems. Let's outline the possible solutions. Let's make a recommendation as to the best solution. And then let's bring this back to the villages to say, okay, these are the options. Do you have any more? You have to do that. You have to say, are there any more solutions? In other words, there might be an idea out there which will supersede, as far as optimum use, anything that we might come up with. Again, we cannot do the same thing, especially we cannot assume to be experts for our own people. Then we will be doing the same thing that everybody else has been doing down through the years, that of saying, okay, I am an expert, I know what is best for you. And that is the primary problem with not only ANCSA, but with the problems that we are having with the state and federal government now. Everything comes from the outside in, and yet they're always saying everything has to be developed at the grassroots level. Thank you.
Well, David Getchies, did you want to, was your hand up?
Well, yes, it was. I wanted to pick up on something that Sheldon said and relate it to something I know you wanted to get into concerning tribal courts. Sheldon made a statement that I think has been a recurring or developing theme here. He said that ANCSA was a blanket solution without allowance for the differences among villages and different types of people throughout the state of Alaska, different sizes of villages as far as population and land and differences in culture and so on. And we know those differences are very real. And he also indicated that you can't expect a village of 200 people to develop a court system. And I'd like to say, as far as the first statement, I think that that is a developing theme and one that I heartily concur in. The second statement, you can't expect a village of 200 to develop a court system, maybe is true if you have a notion of a court system as being that kind of court that you find down the street here under the auspices of the state or federal government. But I think that it might be good to hear from experts here like Ralph Johnson and Browning Pipestem on the different types of court systems that exist. I know from my own experience, I've seen the Navajo courts, and if you look through the window, they look just like a court you would find any place in the United States run by a state government. They're nicely appointed courtrooms with judges in black robes and lawyers sitting at tables or advocates sitting at tables and their clients there with them. And if you went inside, you'd notice the first difference, and that is most of the proceedings take place in the Navajo language. But except for that, the rules of evidence are very similar, and so on. On the other hand, if you go a few miles away to some of the more traditional Indian pueblos, you find that they don't have a courtroom like that, or judges that are proceeding according to the rules of evidence and Anglo-Saxon jurisprudence. You might find a cacique, the traditional religious leader of the pueblo, listening to a story about how a young member of the tribe has done something wrong, and listening to the sides of the victim and the perpetrator, and then deciding what needs to be done based on his wisdom. That's a court too. And I think there are a lot of things in between, although I think the tendency is to formalize it. It's not impossible to do away with traditional law ways and customs and so on, and it's not necessary to squeeze it into a mold. And I would like to hear from others on this.
Well, maybe Browning, we could turn to you then. And
Your Honor?
Yes?
I have a short statement that deals with tribal courts. It's only not, it's a one-liner.
It's a All long
right.
one-liner.
All right. Evelyn Hash-Pete, a one-liner.
Okay. In Indian way, or Indian law, in Inupiaq law, women are the judicial branches of our tribe, our kalagis. And when there's a conflict between two men or two brothers, a sister or a woman will go in and speak to both sides and create a negotiation of sorts, a natural liaison, an arbitrator, if you will, but nonetheless an upholder of the law to the finest degree, and keep something from going into our courts, which are still in existence. I was appointed to my by my grandmother right in front of you, Justice Berger, on April 19th at Gulkana. And I'm going to be taking that position in our tribe, in the Neltinan tribe. And that is before we go to a council and have to be embarrassed, I'll come in and scold someone. It's the same with Inupiaq too. Someone will, if you do something wrong, someone will scold you. And I saw a very serious breach today that I felt I had to say this. Because our men are in our high esteem. And we always treat them that way. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I think we've finally reached the subject of tribal courts in Browning. If you and then Ralph would tell us a little bit about them.
Well, let me give a short explanation. I was a tribal judge for about 5 years, and I still hear cases on appeal for several Indian tribes. And you know, before I get straight to the court, it seems to me that if I understand what's being said here, is it, on the one hand, there are a group of people, and maybe I'm not hearing correctly, who are saying we are tribal governments. And on the other hand, I hear some people saying, well, we need to kind of study that out. And I've never been very big on that. And it seems to me that those of you who are tribal governments, now I've been on a tribal council, you know, I live in tribal context, I'm a ceremonial leader. So, you know, I have to live in the significance of the ways of my people, so to speak. And it strikes me that those of you who are interested in getting off a high center, that you need to quit saying you're tribal governments and be one. Because I keep hearing people say, we're one. But I asked earlier if there are any laws. How do you express your governmental status? And mostly what I hear here today is somebody's waiting for you, or somebody, you're asking somebody to recognize you. Would it be all right if I could be a tribal government? And everybody says, uh-uh. And then we come over and gripe about it. So I'm just going to kind of summarize the conversation that way, because let me say to you that the reason that you don't have a tribal court in Alaska is because you have chosen not to have one. About 2 years ago, I did a training session for the State Department of whatever, call the Welfare Department, on the Indian Child Welfare Act.
That's this state?
Yes, here in Alaska. There was quite a bit of concern at that time over the Indian Child Welfare Act, and there were a number of Native participants, none of whom worked for Indian tribes. They worked for corporations, or they did something, they were social workers for the state or someone. Most of the major features of the Indian Child Welfare Act point themselves to the exclusive jurisdiction over Indian children and the transfer of cases involving Indian children that arise outside of the tribe's exclusive jurisdiction to returning that jurisdiction to the tribe. And they placed the tribe in the first level of protection of Indian families and Indian children. You have none of that. The implementation of the Indian Child Welfare Act, its thrust is directed towards state courts and to state agencies that operate with children. Its implementation is really in their court, so to speak. The unspoken of the Indian Child Welfare Act is the maintenance of the tribe's jurisdiction. There is a retrocession provision in there. To my understanding, no group of people in Alaska have applied for any retrocession. To my understanding, no group of people have made any efforts towards seeking transfer of cases to tribal courts to protect Indian children. Yet the authority under the most severe of circumstances exists therein for the creation of a court that had a limited jurisdiction of juvenile nature. Now, let me move to the other parts of it because I think it's a pretty simple and straightforward thing. An Indian tribe is a government. That's end of discussion. Its main function is to pass laws that define the nature of activities that go on within the tribe's jurisdiction. Its laws are enforced in its courts. And tribal laws are enforced principally in tribal courts. Now, the function of a tribal court is to make those kinds of definitions and to apply the tribal law. Now, if you're going to be an Indian tribe, you need to have some laws. And if you're going to have a court, you definitely have to have some laws. I mean, it's just not going to say to come and walk around in Anchorage and say you're a tribal government and wait for somebody to tell you, well, go ahead and be one now. I mean, if you are, then it seems to me that you need to exercise your authority. If you're not, then you need to forget about it. Now, most of the exercise by Indian tribes has been limited of their authorities by the misunderstandings of people about what those authorities are. The nature of the growth of tribal government has come in the areas of people, as the Indian people have better understood the nature of the authority that they have exercised. The court systems likewise have become more or less in that fashion. Where we have the court systems that are imitation non-Indian courts, there are a lot of serious questions that come up about that. And I do know that two of the tribes, now let me give you an example of that. You know, I have been a judge for several tribes in mostly in kind of controversial cases. But we had significant cases that occurred in Oklahoma. And let me tell you, one of your worst problems is going to be you need to settle the affair of the heart first. Because otherwise, you will study and study and study and study and study, and the fuse is already lit on you. Okay? And you can study for however long you want to, and I can tell you that the court we established in Oklahoma, and I have had a firsthand experience in the establishment of more than one court from scratch, where there was no court, where they said that the tribes had no jurisdiction, and we proved that they had jurisdiction and we exercised it. Now, courts and police are the most obvious expression of tribal sovereignty that there is. Now, you can drive through the littlest town in Oklahoma where they got a 1947 Ford for a police car, and a 68-year-old man sitting in there with a little bitty hat, and if you're going 60 miles an hour, you'll slow down when you see that old car sitting there with that thing on the side of it. Now, I don't know whether you have any visible expressions of sovereignty, but the tribal court is probably the most, and I think Professor Johnson would agree with me, it is the most obvious visible element of the tribe's authority as it exists. Now, if you're serious about having a tribal court, I put one together in 1 month. And if you're in a hurry, I can get you one in 2 weeks. So let's don't make it into something that's hard to do. And if you're trying to set up the federal courthouse down here, you need to forget about that. What you need to do is to work on the kind of a court that is useful to you. If it needs part-time judges, if it needs certain kinds of people, you don't have to have everything. We helped a tribe establish a court that was purely for juvenile purposes. We did the code. We went and put the code on the ground and implemented it, where my partner actually sat down with the lady that they said was going to be the court clerk, and we simulated somebody walking in with a piece of paper and took her hand and stamped it as filed, got a file and put it in there. And I'm telling you, they have an exemplary court system. And they are now moving into another code that we have prepared for them that is a full civil and jurisdictional authority. But they have been exercising jurisdiction over children for the last 3 or 4 years. If I were to think of some area that may be of some significance to you, it may be in the area of Indian children, of establishment of a special subject matter jurisdictional court that deals with juveniles. Maybe that's what you would want to do, and you would want to leave your law flexible enough so that I could appear with my best friend. And I don't have to have a lawyer. I can appear with my best buddy, and he says he's a good guy, and he wouldn't have done this. And the judge can take that into account or whatever. There are many forms that you can take. The best form is the form that when you get through with it, your court system looks like an Eskimo, or it looks like an Indian, or it looks like something. If someone were to draw a picture of your court system, it would look like who you are as a people. And sometimes that becomes difficult in various kinds of areas, but I mean, those are goals. Most people have not achieved those. We have achieved those in some ways by appointing people who are culture bearers to be the judges. They don't know very much about due process and the Indian Civil Rights Act. They know quite a bit about the Indian culture. You know, it may be that one of the tribes that we're working with now is trying to set up within one system both forums, where if it's purely an Indian customary matter, you appear in front of one kind of a judge. If it's one where you want to go get a lawyer and have a big hassle over it, well, then we've got the full-blown set of rules where we can administer that and function in that kind of a fashion. Now, I would just say to you that I don't know whether I'm being... Let me give you the Oklahoma experience and we'll be through with it. Your sovereignty, and I can hear that now, is being subjected to a practical test of, is there funding for it? Do we have any funding to be sovereign? That's an interesting idea, because what you end up with is you end up with the golden rule. You know what the golden rule is? The golden rule is we got the gold and therefore we make the rules. And let me tell you, there was a time when it was determined that it would be a lawless situation in the western part of Oklahoma if there was no Indian court. And we fooled around with the court and said, well, next month, maybe we'll have it. Maybe we'll do this thing. Maybe we'll be one. And finally, I was the chief judge, and I finally got so frustrated, I said, whatever the deal is, August 1, we're opening the doors. And it ended all the discussion for everybody on what was the width and breadth and extent of our jurisdiction, and where do we go, and who can say we can do this, and who says something else. And we had everybody sniffing over this carcass and looking it over, and we eliminated all that when we said, August 1, the doors open. It got down to, what color are the files? Do we have a file cabinet? And I'll tell you, the person that we would not have had a court if it had not been for Daley Sambo. Now, I don't know whether you know Daley Sambo or not, but the Indian court in Oklahoma, Daley Sambo pulled it off. I mean, we got down to where we were going to march in to be sworn in, and we wore black dresses. And there wasn't any dresses. And Daley Sambo went over and got 4 black dresses and charged them to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And all the way before, they couldn't figure out how any of these docket books or any of these things. And see, nobody's ever bragged on our court system. You know, I saw where one of the groups got a grant to study out a color-coordinated files for different kinds of things. And, you know, we already had that. We have huge leather docket books. We had file stamps. We keep them in real books. We do a whole lot of things. And all I know is we got down to the question of the relationship between the court and the BIA, and Daley Sambo settled that. She went over and got the four dresses and put them on the judges and charged them to the BIA, and they paid for them. Because we were down to we were going to be embarrassed if we didn't proceed. So at some point, somebody's got to decide that you're either going to proceed or you're not going to proceed. Because otherwise, you keep sniffing the carcass. Is the lower 48 model a good one? Well, who knows? Is it going to fit us? Well, how are you going to know if you don't even know what it is in the first place? I mean, most of you have never been to a tribal court. So people will tell you that it's this big deal. It's mostly like a municipal court. They have many forms. And if your tribe has lots of money, one of the tribes that I work with a lot are the Utes in Utah. They have lots of money. They have a courthouse. Got a jail on one end. Got the whole works. It's most beautiful place. You feel great when you go in there. It has an august courtroom. I have been where they took out a folding table like these bingo tables. Put one of those over. And I sat down and conducted court for them. But the function of that is the enforcement of law. Indian tribes are people who make laws. Their enforcement function is carried out in the courts. If you don't have any laws, you don't need any courts. If you're not planning on having any, you don't need any. And you can create those as narrow or as broad as to what you want to do. Now, I'm a great believer in traditional courts. But those things, you need to set out what those are, because many of those are extremely important to you. And if your laws and your ways, because the law itself becomes a function of cultural retention, becomes a function of we are the people who make this law. We are the people who believe this. We are the people who do this. We are the people who think this. And that becomes the law, and it becomes expressed in that fashion. Because I think it is based there, that is the whole nature of it. You cannot have a tribal court that's not created. I think it has to be even created by the tribe. You can have a nice CFR court like what we have, or you can do it anyway. But there are many ways to form it. But it becomes an affair of the heart as to whether you are or you're not. Because this whole idea is one that finds itself in its expression. As lawyers, we don't know a thing about sovereignty other than what somebody wrote because some Indian tribe tried to exercise it. I'll tell you that right now. You could not get anyone to define the width and breadth of sovereignty other than what is in a bunch of cases. And those have come when an Indian tribe said, we are the people who do this. And courts have either confirmed it or denied it. Now, that doesn't mean that there are impractical aspects to that. That means that it's a matter of the heart. And you're a people much like my people. And I feel some kindred to you. So I'm not just kind of, I could go around saying, well, I could do it like this, and maybe it could be like that. I have lived through an experience where the people that I come from were told that they were nobody in the terms that we're talking about them, that they couldn't have a court. And that is no longer true. Now, whether you have a good one or not becomes a different function. But the having one is one that is an affair of the heart. And you either have it or you don't. And I would just say to you that the tribal courts, in that sense, are the most visible and obvious expressions of the tribe itself. And once our tribal court was established, we acquired all of the jurisdictional problems. But that was kind of a luxurious thing. Now we can sit around and talk about our jurisdictional problems. Before, we didn't have any, because we didn't have any jurisdiction. we have acquired all kinds of intergovernmental type agreements, because that's luxurious now. We didn't have any before, because nobody wanted to enter into one with us. We can talk about our codes and our laws and the problems that they bring. And they do. Being a government is a problem, ladies and gentlemen. It's no fun being a government. It's a serious undertaking that you see, and it becomes expressed in these many terms. And there is a balance sheet to it. And that's one, but the first element that goes into the balance sheet is the affair of the heart. That's heavy. It weighs heavily in that balance sheet, because you won't do anything else. But it's a matter of the exercise. And I think that the tribal courts are the functional exercise of that. And I'll say it to you again. We have established a court for one group of people in 1 month. And if you're in a hurry, it can be done in 2 weeks. So that's not a, I don't see that as a impossible task. And let me defer to Brother Johnson.
Well, before you do that, I think we do have to leave at 4:30. Do we, Don, or can we? Oh, okay. Well, let's defer to Brother Johnson.
It's hard for me to